too, much of it the direct result of the extreme hardship of Jackson's marches. Though the new recruits were most susceptible to this, forced marches with scant rations and minimal equipment in brutal weather conditions affected the veterans, too. On May 3, Jackson listed the Stonewall Brigade as containing 3,681 soldiers. Less than 3 weeks later, a mere 1,600 remained, a loss of 57% of the force. Such reductions were not limited to Jackson's favorite brigade. "We are all broken down with fatigue, loss of sleep, and irregularity in eating," wrote Brigade Commander Samuel V. Fulkerson to his sister on May 16. "Jackson is killing up all my men." He estimated that his brigade had been reduced by half. As Jackson approached Front Royal, his division had less than 5,000 of the original 8,600 available for duty. The result was that Jackson had far fewer troops than the Confederate command thought he did, so his actual strength was closer to 12,000 effectives. That was at least 4,000 fewer than anybody thought. Whatever the true number, it served as no deterrent to Jackson's plans, which were now focused on cutting Banks off from his lines of supply and communication and destroying him. Jackson had made a good start. Once again, he had made an army disappear, only to reappear where the Union command did not expect to see it, and far sooner than Banks or anyone in the War Department in Washington would have believed physically possible. Though the existence of the single pass through the Massanutten connecting the Shenandoah and Luray Valleys was a mystery to no one, Shields had just passed through it on his march to Fredericksburg, Jackson had used it just as effectively, in combination with Ashby's lethal cavalry screens, as he had used the Virginia Central Railroad in his advance on McDowell. It was as though Jackson had warped time itself. Neither Banks nor Fremont nor any other Union commanders had ever moved with such sustained, deliberate, and determined speed over such large distances. They did not yet understand a general who virtually jettisoned his regimental supply trains, ordered his men to march without knapsacks or tents, and with only light haversacks and a few days' cooked rations, who was happy to have his men sleep on the ground in the rain or snow and get up before dawn and march all day, day after day. Though Milroy and Schenck had certainly learned how fast their army could move when fleeing, in mortal peril, from Jackson, no commander in the war had yet done anything like what Jackson had done on a sustained basis. Union commanders did not think to look for Jackson in the Luray Valley, because they did not think he could possibly have marched his men that quickly from Franklin, a distance of 90 miles, in bad weather over mostly substandard roads that included mountainous terrain. They were looking for him, once again, where he wasn't. At about 2 p.m. on May 23, while Ashby sliced west to cut telegraph lines, Jackson's Maryland and Louisiana regiments, emerging from the shadows of the Luray Valley, drove in the Union pickets and swept away the provost guard in the small village of Front Royal. Then they smashed into Colonel Kenly and his roughly 1,000 men in camp just north of town. Like Banks, Kenly was taken completely by surprise. Like Banks, he had no idea that Confederate infantry was even in the general area. And because Banks, for some reason, had allotted him no cavalry, he had possessed no way to see what was coming at him. What followed was a surprisingly spirited fight, considering the lopsided Confederate advantage. Kenly, who had no idea how big a force he was facing, gamely withdrew to a promontory called Richardson's Hill. And there, with a couple of rifled 10-pounder Parrott guns, he held off the Confederates for 2 hours. He was actually quite lucky that he wasn't simply blasted off the hillside, as he should have been. His luck came in the form of a critical mistake by Jackson's artillery chief, Stapleton Crutchfield, who had graduated first in the VMI class of 1855 but had not yet fully learned his craft. He had ordered shorter-range smoothbores to locations appropriate only for longer-range rifled guns. This meant that they did not have the range even to suppress Kenly's own tiny battery, which, in the absence of counter-battery fire, was devastatingly effective. But Kenly did not have the numbers to last. At 4:30, as his Union regiment was slowly being surrounded, he fell back across the two forks of the Shenandoah that met just north of Front Royal and found another piece of high ground, where he made another valiant stand, using his cannons to maximum advantage. Jackson, impatiently watching the action and lamenting the unforgivable absence of cannon fire, "Oh, what an opportunity for artillery," he complained later in the battle, ordered Flournoy's cavalry to seize the Parrott guns. At 6 p.m., finding himself again in the closing jaws of a trap, Kenly, who still did not comprehend that he faced a 20-to-1 disadvantage, fell back northward again to the hamlet of Cedarville to make a final stand. As Flournoy's four companies of cavalry closed in on what was left of his force, Union riflemen delivered one last devastating volley. Then, as they tried to reload, the Confederate horsemen were upon them. What followed was a rare, rollicking, often hand-to-hand fight between cavalry and infantry, featuring flashing sabers cleaving skulls, arms, and hands, clubbed muskets thudding against wheeling horsemen, the crack of pistol fire, and the screams of men and horses. Colonel Kenly's head was split open by a saber. He would survive, but the battle was soon over. The Union soldiers who fled were quickly rounded up and captured. Though Kenly and his men had fought bravely, the battle was a thorough defeat for the Union. Once again, Jackson's brilliance and strategic maneuver had made the fight itself almost an afterthought. At a cost of only 36 killed or wounded, Jackson had killed or wounded 83 and captured 691 Union soldiers. He had secured large quantities of commissary, quartermaster, and sutler's supplies, and had captured two splendid rifled cannons. After the battle, Jackson remained on the field for several hours, overseeing the roundup of the prisoners and making sure his precious captured supplies were properly collected and inventoried. The day had been a rousing success. Not the least of it was General Ewell's personal epiphany. His courage in standing by Jackson had paid off, and his opinion of the man had changed. "The decided results at Front Royal," wrote Ewell, taking no credit for himself, "were the fruits of General Jackson's personal superintendence and planning." It seemed that the crazy general actually knew what he was doing. Chapter 27, A Lethal Foot Race. Banks decided to run as fast as he could back to Winchester, 18 miles north of his Strasburg camps. As he saw it, there was nothing else he could do. If he fled with his army over the mountains to the west, he would have to abandon his enormous cache of food, medicine, and equipment. To stand and fight, with rebel armies in his front and rear, as he thought, was suicidal. If he marched north, he at least had a chance of beating Jackson in a foot race, which was exactly how he saw it. "It was therefore determined," Banks wrote later in his official report, "to enter the lists with the enemy in a race or a battle, as he should choose, for the possession of Winchester, the key of the valley, and for us, the position of safety." He did not need to add that the ultimate safety was Winchester's proximity to the Potomac and the north. Union-occupied Harper's Ferry was 30 miles northeast. The day ahead was thus all about maneuver, pitting Banks against Jackson in the very thing Jackson was best at. At about 9 o'clock, on the cool, drizzly morning of May 24, Banks's troops moved out. They were not quite aware yet that they were running for their lives, though this was exactly what they were doing. Ahead of them, already strung out for more than 15 miles along the valley pike, was their enormous train of 500 army wagons, plus another 200 civilian wagons of one sort or another. Some of the wagons that had left before dawn were already rolling into Winchester as Banks's infantry started marching. With them, too, were large numbers of escaped slaves they had collected in their travels. Banks no longer commanded just an army, but a vast assemblage of refugees and whatever assets they had managed to drag along with them. Many believed that Stonewall Jackson would kill them outright. All were terrified of being sent back to their masters. As one Connecticut soldier saw it, there were half as many Negroes as soldiers. They, too, traveled with wagons, some of them almost comically overloaded with human cargo. All were headed to Winchester by a single road, the hard macadam of the Valley Pike. It was a curious exodus, a sort of dark, fearful version of the same army's confident, triumphal march south in March and April. Banks himself was deeply pessimistic. The way north was crossed in two places by main roads where his army and train could be intercepted. He had received reports that a Confederate army was already on its way to Winchester. His army could be sliced in half. Or he could arrive in Winchester only to find the town occupied by rebels. Either way, all or part of his army would be cut off. And of course, he still believed that the main body of the Confederate army, the strange, aggressive Jackson himself, was very likely closing in on him from behind. Though he did not betray his emotions to his officers, Banks believed that he might not survive the day. An hour before he departed, filled with longing for his family and fearful that he might never see them again, he wrote his wife the sort of letter many Civil War soldiers wrote before going into battle. He told her about Colonel Kenly's defeat at Front Royal, complaining bitterly that our government separates its forces into little powerless squads without power to crush the foe anywhere. In his anger at his bosses, he had forgotten that his predicament was largely his own fault. Or maybe that explains his excessive bitterness. Then he as good as bid her farewell. "Kiss the dear children for me. I love them and their mother greatly. Dear Bernie, how I should love to hug her once more. And Fremont and Maud, darling children, how I love them. I want our dear children to be just, to be truthful. That embraces everything. I've been very fortunate in having so good a friend in my wife, and I can never say how dear she is to me. Take care of our dear children. They are very fine creatures. It would be a pleasure to live if only to watch them. But life is not worth much. Remember me affectionately to my mother, my brothers and sisters. I need not write any more. I'm in good health and good spirits, the best. Have perfect confidence in getting through our difficulties. Goodbye." His wife may not have believed his feeble assurances at the letter's end, particularly since they were followed by the resoundingly final sign-off of a man who apparently fully expected to die. Whether he lived or died, Banks's path, at least, was clear to him. Jackson, his larger force bristling on the Union flank, had no such advantage. Ahead of Jackson that day was a chess-like game of contingencies, multiplying options, and psychological puzzles. In spite of advances in weapons and mechanization, communications in the Civil War sometimes seemed to exist on the same medieval level as sanitation and personal hygiene. Just as it seemed incredible that it had taken Banks 8 or more hours to figure out what had been happening 12 miles from him, it would seem to defy logic that Jackson, a man with an uncanny sense of terrain and troop movement, could not get a fix on the location of a 6,500-man army with a 15-mile-long wagon train. Yet that, strangely, is what happened on the day after the Battle of Front Royal. Jackson had put the advanced units of his army on the road at 6 a.m. 2 hours later, they had reached the tiny hamlet of Nineveh, about 8 miles north of Front Royal. The assumption of such a march, of course, was that Banks was withdrawing along his supply lines to Winchester. But that was only a guess. Jackson had received no confirmation that Banks was actually doing that. What little intelligence he had gotten, in fact, from an engineer who had climbed the northern end of Massanutten Mountain to surveil the enemy, was dead wrong. His engineer had told him that Banks had 2 divisions, totaling 12,000 men, instead of the single division he actually had. At 3-1, the real odds, a frontal assault would likely win the day. At 3-2, or 1-1, Jackson's approach had to be much more measured. Jackson, meanwhile, was keenly aware that Banks had other options besides Winchester, a destination the former Massachusetts governor might avoid precisely because, with his men and trains strung out along the valley pike, he would be so completely vulnerable to attack. If Jackson and Ewell lunged toward Winchester, Banks could easily slip behind them, march east through Front Royal, out of the valley, and back to the safety of Washington. Banks could also just stay put at Strasburg, perhaps awaiting reinforcements from Fremont to the west, a logical and extremely plausible option, which created its own complex set of contingencies. And so at 8 a.m., Jackson brought his entire army to an abrupt halt. He waited more than 2 hours for some intelligence of Banks's movements to emerge from the fog of war. Earlier that morning, he had dispatched his cavalry commander, George H. Stuart, with 300 horsemen in the 2nd and 6th Virginia Cavalry Regiments, north and west to the village of Newtown to see what, if anything, was moving down the pike. At 10 a.m., Stuart's riders collided with Banks's enormous line of wagons, the part carrying Federal sick and wounded, where they caused a great deal of havoc before being driven back by artillery. Black teamsters especially had panicked and fled at the sight of Confederate cavalry, leaving several dozen wagons in the ditch. At 11:15, Stuart's courier caught up with Jackson with news of what they had seen. Banks was indeed marching north, wagon train and all. But just where was his main force? Determined to find out, Jackson split his army, leaving Ewell in place north of Nineveh, merely 10 miles from Winchester, and backtracking with his own division through Cedarville and then onward to the valley pike at Middletown. Jackson's patience, already wearing thin, was further tested by a feisty, stubborn force of Federal cavalry, who, fighting to buy time for the main army, held him up for another 2 hours on the road to Middletown. After a long and frustrating wait, the forward units of Jackson's force soon discovered what they were looking for. At 3:30 p.m. at Middletown, they crashed with murderous ferocity into Banks's army, which here consisted of massed groups of cavalry mixed with supply wagons. What followed, as Jackson's troops opened from the Union flank with muskets and cannons, was a scene of such horror that even some of the Confederate participants had trouble watching it. Men and horses fell screaming. Solid shot from the artillery cut massive, bloody chunks out of Union formations. As one Union soldier put it, lying beside his dead horse, there was a mass of living and dying men piled up in a heap on the road. Jackson, rarely bothered by slaughter in battle, later wrote, "In a few moments the turnpike, which had just before teemed with life, presented a most appalling spectacle of carnage and destruction. The road was literally obstructed with the mingled and confused mass of struggling and dying horses and riders." He had shown less sympathy on the battlefield itself. When Henry Kidd Douglas, standing next to him, told him that he thought their attack amounted to murder, Jackson replied simply, "Let them alone." Meaning, let his soldiers do their awful work. Chief of Staff Robert Dabney saw the scene in biblical terms. "Behold the righteous judgment of God," he wrote, surveying the bloody wreck of a once-proud Vermont cavalry regiment. "For these are the miscreants who have been most forward to plunder, insult, and oppress us." Perhaps Jackson saw it that way, too. The clash was over in a few minutes. Jackson's men took 200 prisoners. But the victory was short-lived. Though Jackson had severed Banks's column and destroyed or run off several regiments of cavalry, this had not given him any clearer picture of the location of the main body of Banks's infantry. Had he hit the head, midsection, or tail of the snake? Unknown to him, Banks, upon hearing about Stuart's attack that morning, had ordered his infantry to leapfrog the long wagon train. Much of his army was thus well down the road to Winchester when Jackson arrived in Middletown. Banks himself arrived in Winchester at about 7 p.m., about 2 hours after his advance units. Jackson had, in fact, struck the rear guard, the snake's tail. Still, he did not know that. He wanted to destroy Banks's entire army, not just a piece of it. And in the service of that idea, he now made what would turn out to be an extremely costly mistake. Hearing the musket fire of a minor skirmish between stranded Union troops, and the 9th Louisiana, he now guessed, incorrectly, that a significant portion of the Union Army still remained cut off on the north side of Newtown. So he turned his army south. It took him another full hour and a half, until 5:45, before he finally understood that he faced only a small and insignificant Union force. He immediately sent a rider to Ewell, who was stewing yet again about sitting and doing nothing all day, with a message saying, "Major General Jackson requests that you will at once move with all your force on Winchester." Nearly 12 hours after his first units started out toward Winchester, Jackson finally launched the all-out pursuit of Nathaniel Banks. Little daylight remained. The distance between Middletown, where Jackson started his final push, and Winchester was about 12 miles. Some of Banks's infantry and supply wagons were still on the Valley Pike, en route to Winchester. But they were no longer vulnerable to the sort of attack that would have destroyed them outright a few hours before. Darkness fell, and with it came a series of Union rearguard actions starting at Newtown, ambushes really, that slowed Jackson's march to a crawl. Nor could Ewell, leaving as late as he did, and arriving near Winchester sometime after 10 p.m., have hoped to catch many Union troops. In darkness, they had had to pick their way up the Valley Pike, which was cluttered with abandoned wagons, blankets, guns, oilcloths, sutlers' stores, and other equipment, while the 2nd Massachusetts Regiment and other pieces of Banks's army laid ambushes for them and contested their advance, setting up behind stone walls and opening up with brilliant muzzle flashes that lit up the night. Near Newtown, Ashby's troopers, who had been leading the way, fell out of rank altogether and abandoned themselves to the looting of the Union supply train, stealing anything they could get their hands on, including horses. They were lost to the army. With all the stops and starts, and the stress of federal bullets whirring by them in the darkness, it was another severe march by men who had already marched astounding distances since early March. Soldiers slept as they walked. Each time the army stopped, dozens simply collapsed. Jackson's objective had been a high ridge just southwest of Winchester. At 3 a.m., the army paused just north of Kernstown, the site of a battle that already seemed to have taken place a long time ago in a very different world. Jackson fully intended to drive his army those last few miles. With his men dropping out by the hundreds, often face down, asleep, Colonel Samuel Fulkerson summoned up his old authority as a Virginia state judge, approached Jackson, and told him that enough was enough. He had to stop and rest his army, or he would not have an army to fight with in the morning. "My men are falling by the roadside," he said. "Unless they are rested, I shall be able to present but a thin line tomorrow." Jackson listened patiently, then said, "Colonel, I do not believe you can feel for your men more than I do. This is very hard on them, but by this night march I hope to save many valuable lives. I want to get possession of the hills of Winchester before daylight." Jackson thought for a moment, then said, "Colonel, you may rest your command for 2 hours. I will go on with my own brigade." But he soon relented. Though he hated giving up the high ground and would not have ordered a halt on his own, he realized that he had pushed his army to the limits of its endurance. It had been a strange, unsatisfying day with an inconclusive finish. What was undebatable was that because of his own prudence and caution, however justifiable, Jackson had missed one of the great opportunities of the young war, to swallow an enemy army whole. Ulysses S. Grant had done it at Fort Donelson in Tennessee 3 months before, the only general to do so in the first year of the war. He was famous for it. President Abraham Lincoln and Secretary of War Edwin Stanton, pleased with the success of their military mission to Irvin McDowell's army, arrived in Washington shortly after sunrise on May 24, having steamed through the night up the Potomac River. They bid a hearty good morning to their colleague Solomon P. Chase, Secretary of the Treasury, who wrote in his diary that the two men were highly gratified by the condition of the troops and anticipating an imposing and successful advance against Richmond on Monday the following. The trip had in fact been one of the high points of Lincoln's brief career as commander-in-chief. His buoyant mood ended abruptly the moment he and Stanton walked into the War Department and saw the grim, crestfallen faces of their staff, who had just received word of Jackson's rout of Kenly at Front Royal. Throughout the morning, the news got worse as dispatches streamed in from the valley. Some were accurate, some wildly wrong. Banks was fleeing down the valley. Banks was cut off from Winchester. 6,000 to 10,000 rebels were on the road to Winchester. All this was made worse by the doomsday dispatches from the headquarters of Brigadier General John Geary, who commanded an infantry regiment and some cavalry on the eastern side of the Blue Ridge, whose main purpose was to guard the Manassas Gap Railroad. Trusting unreliable sources, a nearly hysterical Geary reported that some 20,000 rebel troops were closing in on him from the west and south, meaning that at least one of those armies was headed in the general direction of Washington, D.C. None of these phantom rebel armies existed. But with the panic Jackson had created ricocheting around Washington, no one in the corridors of power could yet be sure of that. From Harper's Ferry came a deeply disturbing telegraph, saying the rebels have cut the wires between Strasburg and Winchester, and that there was fighting within 8 miles of Winchester. By mid-afternoon, while Banks moved north and Jackson was still trying to figure out where his adversary was, Lincoln and Stanton, now in their own thick fog of war, had concluded that General Banks had likely been cut off at Middletown and was therefore stranded midway between Strasburg and Winchester without his supply lines. Wherever he was, the reports all indicated that he was in grave danger. If Banks was in trouble, of course, so potentially were the garrison at Harper's Ferry and the B&O Railroad, Washington's lifeline to the west. No one had to remind the War Department that in Confederate hands, specifically Jackson's hands, the Shenandoah Valley also constituted a loaded shotgun pointed directly at Washington. Most Union forces in Virginia were either at Fredericksburg or in front of Richmond. What exactly was there to stop Jackson from marching on Washington? He had a habit of popping up in inconvenient places, and there was no telling where he might appear next. Lincoln acted calmly and resolutely, considering how badly he had just been whipsawed, and in spite of whatever regret he may have felt in having stripped away troops from the valley to feed McClellan's ego. In response to this news, he sent 3 telegrams, one to John Fremont, one to Irvin McDowell, and one to George McClellan. Fremont was immediately dispatched to save Banks. The exposed condition of General Banks makes his immediate relief of paramount importance, Lincoln said. You are therefore directed by the President to move against Jackson at Harrisonburg and operate against the enemy in such a way as to relieve Banks. To McDowell, he delivered the harsh news that he was chopping his prodigious command in half and sending half of it to save Banks. You are instructed to lay aside for the present the movement to Richmond and to put 20,000 men in motion at once for the Shenandoah. To McClellan, who still believed he was facing a rebel army well in excess of 100,000 men, he gave the worst news of all. McDowell's entire force would now be withheld from him. It was McClellan's oldest and worst nightmare, to be deprived of troops by cynical politicians and left to face a numerically superior enemy. Judging from the reactions of Fremont and McDowell, one would have thought that traveling to the Shenandoah to fight Stonewall Jackson was a cruel fate indeed. This is a crushing blow to us, replied McDowell, whose main argument was that he could never get there in time to help Banks, needing at least 10 days to get 20,000 men into the valley. He later added, with undisguised bitterness, as though his job really did not consist of doing what his commander-in-chief asked him to do, I shall gain nothing for you there and shall lose much for you here. It is therefore not only on personal grounds that I have a heavy heart in the matter, but that I feel it throws us all back, and from Richmond north we shall have our large masses paralyzed and shall have to repeat what we have just accomplished. He closed by asking Lincoln if he wanted McDowell to personally command such an expedition. The answer, to his chagrin, was yes. To make doubly certain that McDowell would comply, Lincoln immediately dispatched Salmon Chase to explain the orders to him in person. Fremont, while nominally agreeing to obey the order, also tried mightily to beg off. The last thing he wanted was to be sent to rescue Banks. The enemy was everywhere around him, he told Stanton. He had few supplies. As usual, rain had bogged down the mountain roads, and so on. He found no sympathy. From Lincoln he received an irritated reminder that this movement must be made immediately. Of the three recipients of Lincoln's missives, only McClellan, uncharacteristically, appeared to take the news well, replying stoically that I will make my calculations accordingly. The next day, however, he was writing his wife with more indignation than usual, saying that the president is terribly scared about Washington and that it is perfectly sickening to deal with such people. I get more sick of them every day, for every day brings with it only additional proofs of their hypocrisy, knavery, and folly. Thus did Jackson, who had not yet even engaged with the main body of Banks's troops, rearrange on a single afternoon the carefully laid Union plans to join together two armies at Richmond and thus bring crushing numbers to bear against Joseph Johnston. By the night of May 24, more than 35,000 troops were under orders, quite specifically, to stop Stonewall Jackson. Chapter 28, The Taking of Winchester. The evening after his army's miraculous escape from a more powerful enemy, Nathaniel Banks wired Lincoln to tell him that he had arrived safely in Winchester. Considering what had just happened to him, his dispatch was remarkably self-possessed. "I concluded," he wrote the president, "that the safest course for my command was to anticipate the enemy in the occupation of Winchester. My advance guard entered this town at 5 this evening, with all our trains in safety." Put in those unembellished terms, Banks's situation didn't sound so dire after all, though in the past 30 hours he had actually lost more than 25% of his supplies, and more than 100 of his men had been killed or wounded, and another 1,000 taken as prisoners. But he had somehow outrun Jackson and Ewell, and against all odds, he had arrived with most of his division intact in the sanctuary of Union-occupied Winchester, though his escape had been more the result of the Confederate fog of war than of his own tactical acumen. Lincoln's worst fear, that Banks had been cut off, had not been realized. Whatever comfort this may have offered the president or his War Department in Washington, however, was pure illusion. The stark truth was that as of dawn on Sunday, May 25, Banks and his entire army were in immediate danger of annihilation. Though Jackson had not caught his adversaries on the road, he had actually won the Battle of Maneuver by pushing his troops so relentlessly the night before, closing hard on his enemies, and precluding any possibility of reinforcement or unmolested retreat. He had thus left Banks only one option other than surrender, to protect his supply trains and whatever retreat he could muster. Banks had to fight. The alternative, instant headlong flight before Jackson and his preternaturally aggressive cavalry, was unthinkable. At the same time, the raw Confederate numerical advantage meant that Banks was going to lose the fight. And though the dapper New Englander, as he gamely put it, was determined to test the substance and strength of the enemy by actual collision, the only real question was how badly and how quickly he was going down. Whatever his faults may have been, Banks did not lack courage. His practical-minded division commander, General Alpheus Williams, had already concluded privately that he and his men were going to be prisoners of war. For Union troops, the dreary Sabbath dawn heralded approaching death, destruction, and imprisonment. They would fight hard anyway. The Battle of Winchester began on the foggy morning of May 25 at 4:30 a.m., with the sharp crack of Jackson's muskets and the rolling thunder of his artillery. He and his division were drawn up just south of town on the western side of Valley Pike. Ewell, with smaller numbers, some 2,000 troops, was on the right, east of the pike. Union regiments were in place on the high ground in front of them. The battle line stretched east to west for 1.5 miles. For 3 hours, the two sides engaged, 8 Union-rifled Parrott guns and 16 mostly smoothbore Confederate cannons, issued forth sheets of flame and smoke, shook the earth, and rattled windows in Winchester, while pulses of crackling musket fire swept across the fields south of town. Soldiers who were there that morning described a strange and terrible beauty on the battlefields, an effect of swirling fog and bright sunshine, dew sparkling on wheat fields, and shells bursting over the town in perfect white spirals, with jets of white flame piercing billows of white smoke. Some of the fighting was desperate. At 5:30 a.m., Ewell sent the 21st North Carolina Regiment forward into what amounted to a perfect trap, sprung by the 5th Connecticut. In less than 2 minutes, the rebels sustained 75 casualties. In 20 minutes, they lost 18 dead and 78 wounded. As the barrage continued, Jackson seemed to be everywhere, roaming on horseback among his various batteries, urging the men on, barking specific orders at regimental commanders. At one point, he approached Colonel John Neff of the 33rd Virginia. Gesturing toward an unoccupied spot on the high ground of Bowers Hill, he shouted, "I expect the enemy to bring artillery to occupy that hill, and they must not do it. Do you understand me, sir? Keep a good lookout and your men well in hand, and if they attempt to come, charge them with bayonet and seize their guns. Clamp them, sir, on the spot." At 7:30 a.m., after 3 hours of inconclusive fighting, and while Banks's supply wagons rolled quietly north toward safety, two important things happened. First, fog descended like a stage curtain east of the Valley Pike, silencing what had been a brisk fight between Ewell and his Union counterpart, Colonel Dudley Donnelly. Second, while church bells tolled from the nearby streets of Winchester, Banks's brigade commander, Colonel George H. Gordon, decided to make a bold tactical move. He ordered the feisty, battle-tested 2nd Massachusetts, which had harassed Jackson's vanguard the night before, to extend his battle line on the Union right, the logical prelude to an attempt to turn the Confederate flank. Confederate Brigadier General Charles S. Winder, in command at the front, saw the movement and immediately countered it, throwing 3 regiments out to his left. Unfortunately for Gordon, a flanking game was not one he could win. He did not have the manpower. Winder saw that, too. Just then, Jackson came forward to ask him for a report on the progress of the battle. Winder told him that he thought the Union right could be taken. Jackson surveyed the battlefield and replied simply, "Very well, I will send you Taylor's brigade." He meant 36-year-old Brigadier General Richard Taylor, a Yale graduate and successful sugar planter, but most conspicuously the son of Mexican-American war hero and U.S. President Zachary Taylor. Though he was widely read in history and fluent in French, and a Southern gentleman from a long line of planters, Taylor also had the common touch and could swear like a stevedore. His men liked him. He was chosen because he was a hard fighter with a disciplined unit, the exceptions were the unruly Louisiana Tigers, and also because he happened to command the largest Confederate brigade on the field, with 2,500 officers and men. What happened next was a classic example of a successful Civil War flanking maneuver, using the advantage of numbers to extend a battle line farther than the enemy could extend his, then turning the enemy's flank and making him face fire from 2 directions. When Taylor came up, Jackson pointed to the ridge and the right wing of the Union Army and said, "You must take it." Taylor and his brigade now moved forward. Jackson, who liked being in the bullet-shredded air of the front lines, rode with them. They soon emerged from the base of the hill that had screened them and into full view of the enemy on the higher ground. Taylor told Jackson sternly that this was not the place for the commander of the army. Jackson ignored him. A few minutes later, Federal muskets and Federal artillery loosed a howling volley. Many of Taylor's men fell. Others, hearing the whistle of shot and shell about them, began ducking their heads. This angered Taylor, who saw much more difficult work ahead of them. "What the hell are you dodging for?" he shouted at them. "If there is any more of it, you will be halted under this fire for an hour." Chastened, the men straightened up and moved forward. Taylor was struck, though, by the look of reproach on Jackson's face. Jackson put a hand on Taylor's shoulder and said, amid the storm of lead and steel, "I'm afraid you are a wicked fellow." Then he turned and rode away. Jackson was referring to Taylor's choice of language, which certainly was not what he admitted to in his memoir. Most of our current profanities were then in use. Whatever he said, Jackson had believed it was worth a mild reproof, even in the heat of battle. As Taylor's brigade shook itself out into battle formation, an immaculate gray line 1,000 yards across, in full view of both armies, there was a strange pause. The fire slackened momentarily, as though in anticipation of what was quite obviously going to happen next. The Louisianans advanced. Up the hill they came in perfect order. Taylor in front, with sword in hand, closing about half the distance between them and the Union troops. From behind a stone wall came a crackling volley, slicing through Taylor's ranks. But the Louisianans held their tight formation and continued to advance. On Taylor's command, they charged. As he later wrote, with cadenced step and eyes on the foe, the men swept grandly over copse and ledge and fence to crown the heights from which the enemy had melted away. Within minutes, they had routed the enemy without firing a shot. And now, in a cascading sequence of companies and regiments, the entire Union line broke. Watching them run, Taylor's Confederates now opened fire. "The air seemed to be full of whizzing bullets," recalled Union General Williams, "which stirred up currents of wind as if the atmosphere had suddenly been filled with some invisible cooling process." East of the pike, where the fog had finally lifted, Union soldiers were also falling back into Winchester. Ewell, able to see the foe at last, unleashed a brigade under Brigadier General Isaac Trimble, which swept east of the town to cut Union Colonel Dudley Donnelly on the Martinsburg Road north of town. Jackson watched all of this, seated on Little Sorrel, his hand held high in what everyone by now believed was prayer. Then, according to cartographer Jedediah Hotchkiss, as the enemy wavered and they broke and fled, he swung his old gray cap and shouted, "Now let's holler." His staff began to cheer, and then the whole advancing line took it up. And the rebel yell rose to what Henry Kidd Douglas remembered was a deafening roar, which, borne on the wind over Winchester, told her imprisoned people that deliverance was at hand. It was between 8:30 and 9 in the morning. The battle had lasted 4 hours. Jackson's soldiers were back on the streets of Winchester. The Union retreat was, at first, a relatively measured affair. Somehow, Banks's infantry managed to stay with their companies and regiments. But such discipline could not last. The citizens of Winchester, particularly the women, shot at them with muskets and pistols from windows and doorways and shops as they passed through the streets. They threw glass bottles at the Federals, poured scalding water on them, and screamed insults. At least one woman shot a soldier dead with a pistol at point-blank range. Another woman who fired on a colonel was shot dead, a bright red spurt of blood erupting from her breast before she fell. Jackson's troops were shooting at the flying Federals, too, many of whom laid down their arms and surrendered. The enemy rose on the rise on the northern end of Winchester and poured a sharp fire of musketry into our confused rear, remembered Banks's aide, David Hunter Strother. Presently, cannon boomed and shot whistled and shells hurtled over our heads. At every report, the living mass started and quickened its motion as if by electricity. Overcoats and knapsacks strewed the fields. Soon the army was in full chaotic flight north, on the road to Martinsburg and the Potomac beyond. Union soldiers were running for their lives now, and they knew it. More than 1,000 of them had already been taken prisoner in the streets of the town. For the rest, it was their excellent luck that Jackson's army was in no position to pursue them. Many of the Confederates, having slept less than 2 hours the night before, were so exhausted that they simply sat or lay down. Then, too, there was the utter pandemonium inside the town, now cluttered with discarded equipment, discarded wagons, and burning buildings, plus large numbers of blacks, part of Banks's enormous mule train, many of whom were escaped slaves who had to be rounded up. All of this was complicated by a populace that was wildly ecstatic at its liberation. They rushed out of their houses, many dressed in their Sunday clothes, laughing, screaming, embracing the rebel soldiers, and giving cheer after cheer for Stonewall Jackson and Jeff Davis. Some, wrote Robert Dabney, stood on their doorsteps with their solemn faces bathed in tears and spreading forth their hands to heaven in adoration. They welcomed the troops with hugs and kisses and pails of milk and water and baskets of food. Jackson was dumbfounded at the reception he received. He wrote Anna the next day that it was like nothing he had ever experienced. My precious darling and ever-kind Providence blessed us with success at Front Royal on Friday, between Strasbourg and Winchester on Saturday, and here with a successful engagement yesterday. I do not remember having ever seen such rejoicing as was manifested by the people of Winchester as our army yesterday passed through the town in pursuit of the enemy. The people seemed nearly frantic with joy. Indeed, it would be almost impossible to describe their manifestations of rejoicing and gratitude. Our entry into Winchester was one of the most stirring scenes of my life. Time forbids a longer letter, but it does not forbid my loving my Esposita. He got the same treatment from his own troops. As he came, the men pressed in shoals to the roadside and waved their hats enthusiastically, wrote one of Ewell's artillerymen. It was deafening. I never saw a more thrilling scene. General Jackson himself seemed much affected as he rode uncovered, bowing constantly. Luckiest of all for Banks's hapless forces, Jackson's cavalry support, inconsistent at best, now failed him completely. Because of their inherent speed and the intimidating presence of horses, mounted troops could be devastating in pursuit of a fleeing enemy. But Ashby mysteriously disappeared the previous night. Brigadier General George Stuart, whose troopers were lounging several miles east of town while their horses grazed, refused to obey Jackson's order as delivered by Sandy Pendleton, standing on protocol and saying that he would only obey an order from Ewell. Ewell was then found with some difficulty and the order given. By that time it was too late for Stuart to do much more than annoy the Union rear guard. Jackson halted the pursuit after 5 miles. Without cavalry, and with many of the soldiers in his command at the margins of consciousness, he had little choice. His troops then did the unthinkable. They bivouacked at noon. The day was over. Jackson himself, bone-weary and suffused with victory, rode back to Winchester, entered the Taylor Hotel, refused all offers of food, then threw himself on his bed, face down, with his boots and spurs on, and fell asleep. He had not even bothered to wire Richmond about his victory. He had not communicated with his bosses since May 21. Another day would not matter. Later that night, his wagons finally caught up with his army, and the men were issued their first rations in 48 hours. Banks's men got no such break. That day they lugged themselves 35 miles north toward the sanctuary of Maryland, after having marched 18 miles from Strasbourg to Winchester the day before, all under extreme duress and the threat of death or imprisonment. Jackson's legendary foot cavalry never made such a march after fighting a battle. In 2 days, they had eaten a single meal. They were at the limits of their endurance, marching on fear and adrenaline. To their credit, they conducted a mostly orderly, if utterly demoralized, march. Banks, who had never conducted a retreat before, managed it surprisingly well. He was at his best, buoyant and undaunted, riding among the men and encouraging them, lending a hand with stuck wagons, forcing stragglers back into line. But they were a beaten army. All the way north, they were acutely aware, as General Williams put it, of the probabilities that we should be followed to the river and attacked before a tithe of our men could be crossed. And while all our immense train was parked ready to deepen the awful confusion that must follow. The sense of panic and dread increased on the southern bank of the Potomac that night, where 1,000 campfires burned in the darkness. Teams and wagons, guns and caissons were jammed together, and an exhausted army had to figure out how to cross a 300-foot-wide river that was 4 to 5 feet deep and moving fast. They spent all night crossing. men and horses drowned. But by the next morning, the army was on the north side of the river. Though Banks's report to Stanton was deeply inaccurate in many areas, from his estimate of rebel strength, 25,000 to 30,000, to his assessment of Confederate killed and wounded, triple his own, he said, which was wildly inaccurate, and the number of wagons lost, 55 instead of 106 or more. He could say with reasonable honesty that my command had not suffered an attack and rout, but had accomplished a premeditated march of near 60 miles in the face of the enemy, defeating his plans and giving him battle wherever he was found. In 2 long days of retreats, following a surprise attack by a superior force, Banks had managed to keep most of his army and wagon train intact. Most Confederates would have said that he was lucky to escape with his skin. That was true, too. But Jackson had won a staggering victory. It was striking on both tactical and strategic levels. He had marched his men 177 miles since his victory at McDowell 17 days before, and in less than 48 hours had driven Banks 53 miles from Strasburg and literally into the Potomac River and across the Maryland state line. He had done this even though his artillery had failed him miserably at Front Royal, as his cavalry had at Newtown and Winchester. Jackson's force had suffered fewer than 400 casualties. Banks had lost more than 3,500 men, 3,000 of whom were now prisoners of war. Jackson had already knocked the Union war in Virginia off balance. His victory at Winchester would soon shift the attention of the world from what seemed certain defeat in front of Richmond to the strange, shimmering new possibilities that were rising from the mists of the Shenandoah Valley. Even more important for the Confederate war effort, Jackson's men had captured an enormous stockpile of materiel. It contained $125,185 of high-quality quartermaster supplies, 34,000 pounds of commissary supplies, including bacon, hardtack, salt pork, and sugar, so much of it that Jackson's men began calling their opposing general by a new name, Commissary Banks, 500,000 rounds of ammunition, rifled cannons, 103 head of cattle, and 9,345 stands of small arms. A stand consisted of a rifled musket, bayonet, cartridge belt, and ammunition box. There was also an astonishing trove of medicine and medical supplies, which Jackson's aide Sandy Pendleton thought was probably larger than those in the rest of the Confederacy combined. There were 2 well-stocked military hospitals with a capacity of 700 patients that came equipped with their own staff and Union doctors. Jackson, who could have sent those doctors off to a Confederate prison, instead set a Civil War precedent by giving them immunity to continue their work with wounded Federal soldiers, after which he allowed them to return to the Union Army. In a world grown suddenly very hard and cold for Federal soldiers in the Shenandoah Valley, it was a small bit of Christian charity. Something else had taken place, too, at Winchester, something less tangible, though quite as real as the battle itself. The moment of victory also marked the birth of the legend of Stonewall Jackson, of the idea of the man as warrior and hero that would soon loom much larger than the man himself. What the Confederacy had desperately needed, in a war it was obviously losing, was a myth of invincibility, proof that their notions of the glorious, godly, embattled, chivalric Southern character were not just romantic dreams. Proof that with inferior resources, it could still win the war. Jackson, in his brilliant Underdog Valley campaign, had finally given it to them. His personal eccentricities, his often brutal treatment of his own men and officers, his devout and zealous Christianity, all would from now on be seen as the attributes of genius. His dazzling stand at First Manassas would be seen in this new light. No one on either side of the Civil War would ever look at him the same way again. Chapter 29. Lincoln's Perfect Trap. News of Jackson's victory at Winchester rocked the political and military establishments in Washington. What he had done did not seem quite plausible. He had twice eluded Union forces that had been sent to destroy him. He had moved farther and faster and more secretly than anyone in the Union High Command had believed possible, and had defeated Union forces more than 100 miles apart. He had then pursued his helpless quarries for 30 and 35 miles respectively. He had driven Banks clean out of the South. None of this could be explained by conventional notions of warfare, certainly not by warfare as it was being practiced by any Union commanders of the period. There was something lethal about this Confederate general, something grim and unyielding and inexplicable, and alarmingly single-minded. Whatever dark magic Jackson possessed now made faint hearts in the nation's capital uneasy. Where would he appear next? Rumors multiplied, abetted by Banks's wildly inaccurate estimates of Jackson's strength, and the shrill bleats of alarm from General John Geary, just east of the valley, who reported that fully three Confederate armies were closing in on him, one of which was pointed at Leesburg, which meant that it was also pointed directly at Washington. This was pure hysteria. But the Federal War Department did not know that yet. In the midst of all this speculative frenzy, Edwin Stanton seemed to come completely unhinged. That afternoon, the bearded, bespectacled Secretary of War sent what amounted to an SOS to the governors of 13 northern states, asking for their help in saving the nation's capital from Jackson's ravening army. "Intelligence from various quarters," he wrote, "leaves no doubt that the enemy in great force are marching on Washington. You will please organize and forward immediately all the militia and volunteer forces in your state." To the governors of Rhode Island, Massachusetts, and Pennsylvania, he issued an even more urgent appeal. "Send all troops forward that you can immediately. Banks is completely routed." He also ordered the War Department to take immediate military possession of northern railroads. Treasury Secretary Salmon Chase soon joined the paranoid chorus, saying that Jackson's army had endangered Harper's Ferry and even Washington. Even U.S. senators were spreading the word that Banks was flying, that Washington was menaced. Lincoln, too, was upset by the news from the Valley, but whatever unease he felt soon faded. There is little evidence that he panicked, as many historians have suggested, or that he truly believed that Jackson posed a direct threat to Washington. But he was not above using Jackson's attack to prod the eternally irresolute McClellan into action. In a wire to McClellan on the day of the battle, Lincoln told him that the enemy was driving Banks and threatening Leesburg. "I think Jackson's movement is a general and concerted one," he continued, "such as could not be if he was acting upon the purpose of a very desperate defense of Richmond." Then he closed, "I think the time is near when you must either attack Richmond or give up the job and come to the defense of Washington. Let me hear from you instantly." McClellan responded within a few hours, reassuring Lincoln yet again that the time is very near when I shall attack Richmond, but also pointing out, with his characteristic, finely tuned sense of self-preservation, that Jackson's attacks were designed probably to prevent reinforcements being sent to me. Lincoln's main objective, however, in the wake of Jackson's victory, was not to fortify Washington, but to destroy Jackson where he stood. It was obvious that, isolated in the northern end of the valley, the rebel general was vulnerable, almost absurdly so, given how many Union troops were now converging upon him. Under Lincoln's orders, Fremont was marching post-haste with his 15,000 men from Franklin to the valley, with the aim of cutting both Jackson's escape route and his supply line. McDowell, with 21,000 men, was hurrying west across the Blue Ridge. All told, 36,000 Union troops were presumably on the march, well more than twice Jackson's force. That did not include Banks's 7,000 men just north of the Potomac, bloodied but operational, or another 7,000 at Harper's Ferry, and Geary's 4,000 just over the mountains, bringing the total to 54,000, all of whom might be mobilized. When Lincoln and Stanton heard that Jackson had marched north 3 days after the battle, it seemed to them that in addition to rattling the walls of Washington's parlors and salons, he had also made a fatal error. Jackson did not see it that way. Flight from Winchester after his victory had never crossed his mind. And anyway, his old, unconditional friend, Confederate Congressman Alexander Boteler, had shown up in Winchester on May 27, bearing orders that restated what Lee had told Jackson on May 16. To demonstrate against Harper's Ferry, to seem to threaten points east. Lee and Jackson thought alike, anyway. After the accidental success of Kernstown, it had been Jefferson Davis's idea to use Jackson deliberately to draw off federal forces. Now he and Lee wanted to push this strategy as far as they could, forcing the Union High Command to strip troops from its Richmond and Fredericksburg lines. They did not yet know that they had already succeeded. Neither did Jackson have any inkling of the fear he had inspired in the northern capital. But he fully grasped that there was nothing quite like a victorious Confederate army marching unfettered and unopposed in the Virginia borderlands to get Washington's attention. After letting his exhausted army rest for 2 days, Jackson set it on a northeastward march on May 28. His men, lifted by their stunning victory, were in a buoyant mood. The trials of the past month, the lack of sleep and incessant hard marching in rain and mud, the rancid food and lack of such amenities as real coffee, all seemed to drop away. They had cursed their commander for keeping them in the dark about where they were going and why, but with hindsight they could now see clearly how extraordinary their achievement was. They understood exactly how far they had marched. They could see how their speed, endurance, and hard fighting had won the day. And they now spent hours before campfires reconstructing the campaign and writing proud letters home about how they had done it, from Kernstown to McDowell to Winchester. Many now had a completely different view of Jackson. This group included his crusty, pragmatic quartermaster, John Harmon, who on May 9, the day of the McDowell battle, furious at Jackson on a dozen counts, had written his brother to say that we have been worsted by mismanagement. I am more than ever satisfied of Jackson's incompetency. 2.5 weeks later, following the Battle of Winchester, he was writing his brother breathlessly, "We have not only astonished the Yankees, but moved the world. I cannot believe that such a movement was ever made under the circumstances." One of Jackson's privates wrote home, "This is one of the most brilliant moves of the war, and old Jack will be a greater man than ever." Jackson's burgeoning legend grew in part from his own soldiers' accounts of him. There were also the glowing accounts in the Confederate press, which quickly made their way into the ranks. "The name of Old Stonewall seems likely to become as famous as that of Old Hickory," wrote the influential Richmond Dispatch. "His last victory appears to have been a crusher. In all the transactions this year, Jackson has proved himself to be a man of high military genius." Wrote the Southern Literary Messenger, "Jackson has proved himself the captain we have all been seeking." And if that were not enough to make the men happy, there was the cornucopia of war delicacies that had been delivered to them at Winchester, which included figs, lemons, oranges, ham, bread, various exotic canned goods, and authentic coffee. On May 28, the army arrived at Charlestown, the town where Jackson and his cadets had provided security for the hanging of John Brown in December 1859, an event that now seemed a lifetime away. The Stonewall Brigade, under Brigadier General Charles S. Winder, fought a brief engagement with 1,500 Union troops, whom they quickly drove away. By the morning of May 29, the main body of Jackson's army was camped 3 miles from Union-occupied Harper's Ferry. There he sat, unchallenged for the moment, a mere 60 miles upstream of Washington on the Maryland border. That a Confederate army could do this at all, a year into the war, was the point of the exercise. Jackson had no illusions about what was going to happen to him. That same day he learned that Irvin McDowell was marching on Front Royal. The next day he learned that Fremont was closing in on him too, from the west. For once, most of his men also understood exactly what was happening. This was not just another retreat southward along the pike. Jackson's move north had placed his army in grave and immediate danger of isolation and destruction. According to Jackson's aide, Henry Kidd Douglas, everyone else thought it very imprudent to go to Harper's Ferry in the first place. But there Jackson stood, and he seemed in no great hurry to leave. Indeed, on May 30, as Union armies closed in, Jackson seemed to operate at an oddly leisured pace. He met a delegation of local ladies in the morning, then in early afternoon rode out to the front to speak with General Winder and observe a minor artillery duel. While the shells shrieked and buzzed, he dismounted, seated himself at the foot of a large tree, then stretched out and fell asleep, where his sometime staffer Alexander Boatler, a talented artist, sketched him, as he put it, with his arms folded over his breast, his feet crossed like those of a crusader's effigy. In Boatler's account, I was busily engaged with my pencil when, on looking up, I met his eyes full upon me. Extending his hand for the drawing, he said with a smile, "Let me see what you've been doing there." And on my handing him the sketch, he remarked, "My hardest tasks at West Point were the drawing lessons, and I never could do anything in that line to satisfy myself. Or indeed," he added laughingly, "anybody else." Such light-hearted moments with Jackson never lasted. In the next instant he was telling Boatler he had important work for him to do. He wanted the congressman to travel to Richmond to try to secure more troops. Such reinforcements could not help him out of his present predicament. It was far too late for that. But Jackson had larger plans. What he told Boatler in this extraordinary moment of peril is revealing of how his mind worked in a crisis. He began by enumerating with remarkable accuracy the forces being mobilized against him. Then, in Boatler's account, Jackson said, "McDowell and Fremont are probably aiming to effect a junction at Strasburg, so as to head us off from the upper valley, and are both nearer to it now than we are. Consequently, no time is to be lost. You can say to them in Richmond that I'll send on the prisoners, secure most, if not all, of the captured property, and with God's blessing we'll be able to baffle the enemy's plans here with my present force. But that will have to be increased as soon thereafter as possible. You may tell them, too, that if my command can be gotten up to 40,000 men, a movement may be made beyond the Potomac, which will soon raise the siege of Richmond and transfer this campaign from the banks of the James to those of the Susquehanna." He was still contemplating a scorched-earth invasion of Pennsylvania, but his more immediate problem was saving himself. He gave orders for the main body of his army to return to Winchester the next day. Winder and the Stonewall Brigade would collect the 2nd Virginia from its mountaintop camp across from Harper's Ferry and follow later. Jackson and Boatler, meanwhile, took a one-car train down the almost comically degraded tracks of the Winchester and Potomac Railroad for Winchester. Jackson fell asleep en route. While he was napping, his mapmaker, Jed Hotchkiss, galloped up to Jackson's car and drew rein at the window. He carried the worst news possible. He told Jackson and Boatler that Colonel Z.T. Connor's 12th Georgia Regiment, which Jackson had left at Front Royal to hold the town and guard captured supplies, had been routed by Union forces. This meant that General Irvin McDowell, or at least his advance unit, was already there. Front Royal was 12 miles east of Strasburg. Jackson's army, meanwhile, was more than 40 miles north of it. The implications were excruciatingly clear. While Hotchkiss waited expectantly for orders, there were none, Jackson read Connor's dispatch. He then tore it into pieces, threw the pieces on the floor, told the conductor, "Go on, sir, if you please," and went back to sleep. The message in Connor's urgent, messy scrawl and sent from Winchester read as follows: "General, just arrived, enemy in full pursuit. Unless immediately succored, all is lost." Connor would soon pay for such melodrama. When Jackson arrived in Winchester, he immediately summoned the colonel to his headquarters and asked him for an explanation. Connor gave him a detailed account of how the Confederates had been overwhelmed by superior Union numbers. "Colonel Connor, how many men did you have killed?" asked Jackson. "None," he replied. "How many wounded?" None, sir. Colonel Connor, do you call that much of a fight? Snapped Jackson, and then dismissed him. As he left the room, Connor remarked to Jackson's commissary, Wells Hawks, Major, I believe General Jackson is crazy. A few moments later, Jackson's aide, Sandy Pendleton, emerged from the general's office. Colonel Connor, he announced, you are to consider yourself under arrest. Amazed, Connor said, Now I know he is crazy. With that encounter, Connor's military career was over. Jackson cashiered him for dereliction of duty. In this case, as opposed to that of the hapless Richard Garnett, Jackson had every reason to do what he did. Connor was not the only one to feel Jackson's wrath. His second in command, Major Willis Hawkins, was arrested for cowardice. For the 12th Georgia, which had fought so courageously and suffered so many casualties at McDowell, it was a calamity of a different sort. If news of his impending doom bothered Jackson, he did not show it. He sent no urgent dispatches to Richmond. He asked no counsel of any of his officers. He wrote no dramatic letters home, as Banks had, bidding a sentimental farewell to his wife as his own death loomed. Jackson seemed, in fact, at the center of this building storm, to be completely calm. Hotchkiss remarked that the general was in fine spirits. That same evening, he had even enjoyed the diversion of Alexander Boteler's company. Boteler later related that he had taken the liberty of ordering two whiskey toddies to be sent up to their hotel room in Winchester, even though he knew Jackson did not drink. When he offered one to Jackson, the general replied, No, no, Colonel, you must excuse me. I never drink intoxicating liquors. I know that, General, Boteler insisted, but though you habitually abstain, there are occasions, and this is one of them, when a stimulant would do us both good. Jackson shook his head, but nevertheless picked up the tumbler and drank part of it. Colonel, do you know why I habitually abstain from intoxicating drinks? Jackson asked. Why, sir, because I like the taste of them. And when I discovered that to be the case, I made up my mind at once to do without them altogether. The presence of McDowell's troops in Front Royal was only one of Jackson's worries. The larger potential threat to him, and the key to his defeat in Lincoln's mind, was not McDowell, but Fremont. The president had studied the map of Virginia and had noticed not only that there was a road from Franklin, where Fremont was camped, to Harrisonburg, but also that the distance was a mere 40 miles. Harrisonburg, in the middle of the valley, lay north of Jackson's supply base in Stanton. As Lincoln saw it, there was no way Jackson could beat Fremont to Harrisonburg, which meant that Jackson would have Union armies to the north and south of him. He would be isolated, his supply lines cut. Even Jackson could not escape from such a trap. Move against Jackson at Harrisonburg immediately, Lincoln had ordered Fremont. Put the utmost speed to it. Do not lose a minute. But General John Fremont, the formerly magnificent but now greatly diminished pathfinder, who had failed in the Western Theater and had thus far been a model of inactivity in the mountains, saw an entirely different world. Fremont had two problems. First, he was a man who insisted on seeing obstacles where none existed. Second, in this case, there actually were obstacles, which made everything doubly bad. Mired in constant rains in the valley of the South Branch of the Potomac, 60 miles from his supply base, Fremont's army had suffered. Many commissary wagons had never gotten through. The men were on less than half rations, prompting Fremont's chief of staff to complain that our people were next to starving. Fremont's more serious problem was that the apparently convenient route on Lincoln's map was actually a horrendously steep, twisting, unsurfaced country road that crossed two mountain ranges. More significantly, during the McDowell campaign, Jackson had anticipated such a crossing and had sent Jed Hotchkiss with a crew of engineers to destroy that and other mountain passes to the Shenandoah Valley. They had done admirable work. Hotchkiss recorded in his diary on May 11 that he had procured axes and crowbars, and by sending details far up into the gorges and cutting down trees and rolling large rocks into the road, made a very effectual blockade, especially of the road leading from Franklin to Harrisonburg. It meant that Fremont, as he saw it anyway, could not follow Lincoln's orders.